Hello, everyone. We're continuing on with Thomas Manton in exposition with notes upon the Epistle of James. Last time we did verse 10, but the rich in that he is made low, because the flower of the grass he shall pass away, because the low person was exalted, and now the rich in that he's made is exalted when he's made low. And then, now we're planning on going on to verse 11. Here, it's a little shorter, but verse 12 is sort of normal, so it seemed long to combine the two. So we're just planning on verse 11 here, and we'll go ahead and start. So verse 11, for the sun is no sooner risen with a burning heat, but it withereth the grass, and the flower thereof falleth, and the grace of the fashion of it perisheth. So also shall the rich man fade away in his ways. He pursues the similitude and in the close of the verse applies it. There's nothing needs illustration but the latter clause. So shall, that is, so may, for the passage is not absolutely definitive of what always shall be, but only declarative of what may be, and therefore the future tense is used for the potential mood. We see many times that the wicked live, become old and mighty in power. Their houses are safe from fear. Neither is the rod of God upon them. Their bull gendereth and faileth not. Their cow calveth and casteth not her calf. Job 21:7-10. Therefore, I say the apostle shows not what always comes to pass, but what may be and usually falls out, and what at length certainly will be their portion. The rich man that is either to be taken generally for the rich, whether godly or ungodly, or more especially for the ungodly persons that trust in his riches. Fade away, a word proper to herbs when they lose their verdure and beauty. In his ways, some read as Erasmus and Gagnius with his abundance, which reading Calvin also approves as suiting better with the context. So shall the rich in all his abundance fade away. But the general and more received reading is that which we follow in his ways or journeys. The word is emphatical and imports that earnest industry by which men compass sea and land, run hither and thither in the pursuit of wealth, and yet, when all is done, it fades like the flower of the grass. The notes are these. Observation 1. From the continuance of the similitude, that the vanity of flowers should hint thoughts to us about the vanity of our comforts. We delight in pictures and emblems, for then the soul, by the help of fancy and imagination, has a double view of the object in the similitude, which is, as it were, a picture of it, and then the thing itself. This was God's ancient way to teach his people by types. Still, he teaches us by similitudes taken from common and ordinary objects that when we are cast upon them, spiritual thoughts may be awakened. And so every ordinary object is, as it were, hallowed and consecrated to a heavenly purpose. Well then, let this be your field or garden meditation. When you see them decked with a great deal of bravery, remember all this is gone in an instant, when the burning heat arises. In the text, it is, let me open that, by the way, I guess in a bit, the sun with a burning wind, so in the original, for the word used here is usually put for the scorching wind, which in the hot and eastern countries was wont or often to accompany the rising of the sun, as Jonah 4, verse 8, it came to pass when the sun did begin to rise, God prepared a vehement east wind. And therefore do we read of the drying east wind in Ezekiel 18 verse 10 and in many places of Hosea. It was a hot, piercing wind that blasted all things and was the usual figure of God's judgment, or a type or an example of or shadow of it in the physical realm of a spiritual thing. And so the psalmist says, the wind passeth over it, and it is gone, Psalm 103:16. But this, by the way, because I omitted it in the exposition. When I say you walk in a garden or field, as Isaac did to meditate, Genesis 24:63, think thus with yourselves, here is a goodly show and paint tree. But alas, these things are but for a season. They would fade away of their own accord, but the breath of the east wind will soon dry them up. So are worldly comforts like flowers in the spring, good in their season, but very vanishing and perishing. Observation number two, that our comforts are perishing in themselves, but especially when the hand of providence is stretched out against them. The flower fades of itself, but chiefly when it is scorched by the glowing, burning east wind. Our hearts should be loose at all times from outward things, but especially in times of public desolation. It is a sin against providence to affect great things. When God is overturning all, then there is a burning heat upon the flowers, and God has gone forth to blast worldly glory. Jeremiah 45:4-5, the Lord saith, I will pluck up this whole land, and seekest thou great things for thyself? That is a preposterous condition in a time of public desolation. It is as if a man should be planting flowers when there is a great wind gone forth to blast them. Well, then, take heed you do not make providence your enemy, then your comforts will become more perishing. You cannot then expect a comfortable warmth from God, but a burning heat. There are three sins, especially, by which you make providence your enemy, and so the creatures more vain or useless. Number one, when you abuse them to serve your lusts, or and in Puritan writings, that usually means corrupt desires of the heart, and not just in a sexual way. When you abuse them to serve your lusts or corrupt desires in your hearts, where there is pride and wantonness, you may look for a burning. Certainly your flowers will be scorched and dried up. Pleasant Sodom, when it was given to pride and idleness and fullness of bread, met with a burning heat indeed, Ezekiel 16:49. In Sulvian's paraphrase, God will rain hell out of heaven rather than not visit for such sins. Number two, when you make them objects of trust, God can brook no rivals. Trust being the fairest and best respect of the creatures, it must not be intercepted, but ascend to God. If you make idols of the creatures, God will make nothing of them. The fire of God's jealousy is a burning heat. God took away from Judah the staff and the stay, Isaiah 3:1, that is, that which they made so, excluding him, for that is the case in the context. So when you trust in your wealth, as if it must needs be well with your families, and you were secured against all judgments and turns of providence, supposedly, certainly God will take away the staff and the stay and show that riches are but dead helps when they are preferred before the living God. 1 Timothy 6:17. And number three, when you get them by wrong means. Wealth thus gotten is flesh, like the eagles from the altar, with a coal in it that devours the whole nest. Habakkuk 2:9, woe be to him that coveteth in evil covetousness, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. You think it is a ready way to advance you by getting these things with wrong means. No, this is the ready way to ruin all. James 5:3, your gold and silver shall be a witness against you and shall eat your flesh as it were fire. That is, draw the fire and burning heat of God's wrath from yourselves upon yourselves and families. From that, his ways. The verse again, so also shall the rich man fade away in his ways. So from his ways, observation number three, worldly men pursue wealth with great care and industry. The rich turn hither and thither. He has several ways whereby to accomplish his ends or purposes. In self-denial, covetousness is the ape of grace. It suffers all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things. 1 Corinthians 13:6-7. What pains do men take for things that perish? Do but observe their incessant care, earnest labor, and unwearied industry, and say, how well would this suit with the heavenly treasure? It is a pity a plant that would thrive so well in Canaan should still grow in the soil of Egypt, that the zealous earnestness of the soul should be misplaced, and we should take more pains to be rich unto the world than to be rich towards God. Luke 12:21. Man fallen is but the anagram of man in innocency. He has the same affections and delights, only they are transposed and misplaced. Therefore do we offend in the measure because we mistake in the object. Or else, secondly, observe their pains and care and say this, shall a lust have more power upon them than the love of God upon me? I have higher motives and a reward more sure. Proverbs 11:18. They are most interest for an earthly purchase and to heap up treasure to themselves than I am to enrich my soul with spiritual and heavenly excellences. Surely grace is an active thing of as forcible an efficacy as corruption. Why then do we act with such difference and disproportion? The fault is not in grace, but in ourselves. Grace is like a keen weapon in a child's hand. It makes little impression because it is weakly wielded. Worldly men have the advantage of us in matter of principle, but we have the advantage of them in matter of motive. We have higher motives, but the more entire principles for what they do with their whole heart. But our principles are mixed, and therefore grace works with a greater faintness than corruption does. But however, it is sad. Pambus, in ecclesiastical history, wept when he saw a harlot dressed with much care and cost, partly to see one take so much pains for her own undoing, partly because he had not been so careful to please God as she had been to please a wanton lover. And that was his point. The ungodly actually are more fervent than oftentimes than the godly in their pursuits of what they should be pursuing, or at least what they do pursue. And of course, the godly should be pursuing God. And truly, when we see men cumber themselves with much serving and toiling and bustling up and down in the world, and all for riches that take themselves wings and fly away, we may be ashamed that we do so little for Christ and they do so much for wealth, and that we do not lay out our strength and earnestness for heaven with any proportion to what they do for the world. Observation number 4, lastly, again, from that Greek words, from his ways or journeys, all our endeavors will be fruitless if God's hand be against us. As the flower to the burning heat, so is the rich man in his ways, that is, notwithstanding all his interest, all his industry and care, God may soon blast him. They earned wages, but put it in a bag with holes. Haggai 1 verse 6, that is, their gains did not thrive with them. Peter toiled all night but caught nothing till he took Christ into the boat. Luke 5 verse 5. So you will catch nothing, nothing will comfort and profit till you take God along with you. Psalm 127 verse 2. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sheep. Some take this place in a more particular and restrained sense, as if David would intimate that all their agitations to oppose the reign of Solomon, though backed with much care and industry, should be fruitless, though Absalom and Adonijah were tortured with the care of their own ambitious designs, yet God would give Jedidiah, or his beloved, rest. That is, the kingdom should quietly and safely be devolved upon Solomon, who took no such pains to court the people and to raise himself up into their esteem as Absalom and Adonijah did. And they ground this exposition partly on the title of the psalm, A Psalm for Solomon, partly on the name of Solomon, who was called Jedidiah, or the beloved of the Lord, 2 Samuel 12:24 and 25. the word used here, he giveth his beloved rest. So some people think that that's what that is talking about. But I suppose this sense is too curious, or they're trying to read too much into it. For though the psalm be entitled to Solomon, yet I think not so much by way of prophecy as direction. For as the 72nd psalm, which also bears title for Solomon, represents to him the model of a kingdom and the affairs thereof, so this psalm, the model of a family, with the incident cares and blessings of it, and therefore the passages of it are of a more universal and unlimited concernment than to be appropriated to Solomon, or I guess just to him. And it is not to be neglected that the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Old Testament, turns the Hebrew word plurally, his beloved ones sleep, showing that the sentence is general. The meaning is then that Manton feels that though worldly men fare never so hardly, beat their brains, tire their spirits, rack their consciences, yet many times all is for nothing. Either God does not give them an estate, or not the comfort of it. But his beloved, without any of these racking cares, enjoy contentment. If they have not the world, they have sleep and rest, with silence submitting to the will of God, and with quietness waiting for the blessing of God. Well then, acknowledge the providence that you may come under the blessing of it. Labor without God cannot prosper. Against God and against his will, in his word, will surely miscarry. All right, that is the end of verse 11. And Lord willing, we'll plan to go on to verse 12 next time. But until then, go in God's graces. And Lord willing, we'll talk to you again soon.